Turn down the music, turn up the voice. Hello, everybody, to episode number 75 of Die Simulanten, your cruise level podcast for flight simulation. A lot of our German listeners now will ask themselves, hey, why are these guys talking or commencing the podcast now in English? Well, there's a simple reason. As in former episodes where we had international guests, we of course start the podcast in English that our guests can understand what we say here. And yeah, today is one of these days where we have a very, 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 very great guest here in our podcast, which we were very looking forward to actually interview, to have to chat about flight simulation. I think he's been around in the community or in the, let's say, in the creator side of maybe for about 20 years, maybe longer. He can tell us himself now. And he created, you could say, one of the most, let's say, immersive, realistic flight simulation add-ons out there, which are, of course, add-ons like the Constellation, the Spitfire, the, and most recently, the Comanche. So I want to introduce to you Scott Gentile of A2A Simulations. Hello, Scott.
Hi. How you guys doing?
Hello. And of course, I forgot, because I'm so excited that you're here. I forgot, of course, to introduce my beautiful co-hosts, which are here with me every 2 weeks. Hello, Rafi.
Hello, everybody.
And hello, Tommy.
Hey, hello again.
Okay. Yeah. So you see, our guest is so important today that I totally forgot about you guys. So don't be mad. So Scott, it's very nice to have you here in the podcast today. I think we, in our German episodes, we all the time talked about, oh, one day we have to get him. We have to get the guy who's responsible for this great add-ons. And now here you are. But you didn't start right off with AcuSim and everything. So, and this is also always the first question for our guests in the podcast. What was your way into flight simulation? Because if I remember it correctly, you started with effects for combat simulators. Is that correct?
I cannot believe you remembered that. Yes. Blade 124's weapon and explosion pack was the first thing I ever did with flight simulation. So that came about over 20 years ago. And I was basically your disgruntled, unhappy, picky as hell customer. The ones that, you know, really drive us nuts, you know? You know, because you get somebody who's overly picky, more picky than you, for example. They do exist out
That's
there.
That's impossible.
People are incredibly, can be, you know, way over the top picky. And they can be persistent. And I think that must have been how I was perceived 20 years ago. I remember thinking big flight simulator since I've been a little kid. And I think that's probably true for, I'm guessing it's true for all of us here, right?
Yes, definitely.
It's in our genes. We really are genetically connected. We really are technically, we're family on some level. I always felt that way.
Because, it's a
lovely, yeah. Yeah, airplanes just had this mystique. I think it's connected to freedom. I think it has something about the freedom of flying and what it represents. So as a kid, of course, or even now, flying is not something that's really affordable for the average person. So, you know, when the first time flight simulator came out, I must have been, I don't know, 12, 13. It was just, you know, mind-blowing. It just, like, it was that by then it was just a little line across the screen going at like four frames know, second.
Yeah.
A dot was the plane you were looking at. You know, it was just like that crazy, but it was so like amazing that those lines would move and give you a perceived 3D image. And back in those days where things weren't photorealistic, our imaginations filled the rest. So we were just okay with those triangles and lines on the screen, monochrome,
yes.
16
right,
color.
Yes.
And our imaginations filled the rest. So our memories of those very early simulators, we don't remember the lines because in our brain, we were filling those lines in with beautiful landscape. Some of those early air combat games like Tornado by Digital Integration. That was a big one. European Air War was a great one. I don't know if it's before your time, but these are like classic air combat games. And that's really where my passion was. I am a pilot, but I always dreamed of flying warbirds.
All right.
And that's where, and the challenge of being in an airplane and having an adversary, whether you're trying to, you know, bomb a target in their territory, get in and get out alive, whether it was dogfighting, you know, stall fighting and playing that angles game. It's like a game of chess, you know? It's just fascinating. And then, of course, what machine do you have? Do you got a BF-109? Do you have a Spitfire? Do you have a P-51? Do you have a P-40? A P-47? What do they all do? They all have the thing that they do best. And I remember the 109 had that awesome climb rate. You could always outclimb your enemy. And some aircraft were designed to go fast and boom and zoom style, and some were designed to turn. If you're flying a boom and zoomer and you're engaging a guy who is good at turning, well, guess what? You didn't slow down. You kept going. Yeah, we learned that from the Flying mm-hmm. Tiger. So that really was the passion. And then something happened along the way, and I think it was actually a financial decision at first, because we had put out an add-on called Firepower. After that Blades Weapons and Explosion Pack, a couple of people reached out to me and said, you know, you really should go into flight simulation. And I hadn't really thought about it as a profession. I thought I was just a flight sim, you know, nut. And I went to Firepower. It was very well received, but the publisher went bankrupt. And I brought on all these people at that time, maybe a team of 8 or 9 people, and I had a deal with them. That's the first time. I'm not a business guy, you know. I just want to make flight sims. I want to make the flight sim that I can't buy in the store. So for 10 years, I thought,
yes.
Oh, they're going to get it next time because this one's got the visuals and this one's got the visual effects. Oh, and this one has the terrain. Oh, and these guys did a great job of the sound. Now we've got it all out there. And then now the cat's out of the bag. Somebody's going to put it all together. Someone's going to figure out, okay, use the sound of that one. Nobody was doing it. It was just mm-hmm. it was just one disappointment after another. This is after the classics, that is, I would say. One thing I remember was SU-27 Flanker. Is that before your time? The first...
No, I remember that one. Yeah.
I remember it as well, yeah.
Now, it was very technical.
I was very young, but I remember, yeah.
Very technical. Extremely good aerodynamics. Oh, the aerodynamics. I used to love putting wingtip smoke on and just watching flyby views and how the wings would push into the air. It was one of the first 6 degrees of freedom flight models. Oh, I love that. But the effects were terrible. The visual effects were bad. And it was practically bad because I actually called the company. They were, what was their name back then? I can't remember. But I reached out. I actually called them, the developer. And I got them on the phone and I said, look, you know, I'm in my airplane. I managed to make it to the target. I just dropped a 2,000-pound bomb on my target. And you're telling me in 30 seconds when I turn around, I'm not going to see where the bomb hit? There's going to be no smoke? Because it would just, like, have a little smoke puff, and then you were left with a crater,
yes.
A 2D crater sitting on the ground, but it was blended in with all the other buildings, so you couldn't find the crater. So you turn around, you can't find your target. I said, give me something. I don't care if it looks bad. Give me circles or something because I should be able to do, turn around and keep it in the same target. And the guy goes, well, computer horsepower isn't enough to be giving us those long, towering things of smoke. And I was like, oh, come on. I realized then that I was dealing with priorities, not technology. And I just realized my priorities were make it real first. Just make sure it's real. Make sure it's practically real. I don't want an immersion killer. That, to me, is an immersion killer. That completely ruins the entire experience because it's now not real. And for what reason? For no reason whatsoever. If I drop a 2,000-pound bomb and I've got a couple other bombs left or rockets or something, maybe I'll decide to launch a few rockets in there just to mark the target, you know? You can't do that. So anyway, what happened was firepower was a great a hit publicly. It sold a lot. It was the highest rated game that ever came out. That was an add-on, but it was just getting all these great awards and PC Gamer. I was so happy with it. But the publisher went bust. So I'd promised these guys, 8 or 9 of them, a percentage of profits. And of course, there were no profits because the publisher went bust. So I had a decision to make. I was like, okay, I can't tell these guys, oops, sorry, guys, all that work we did, that whole year we worked in this thing, there's nothing there, right? That's because it was ultimately my responsibility because I did the deal with these guys. Perhaps I wasn't prudent enough. Perhaps I should have gotten more cash in advance. I learned that lesson. Never sign a contract without cash on the table, okay? That if someone's going to hesitate putting cash on the table, walk away. Those were back in those days. So lesson learned, my mistake. So I went into debt to pay these guys. I took a mortgage out from my house, went into debt, pretty bad debt, because I realized I wanted to stay in the business. I knew I had a place, and if had I said to these guys, "Oops, sorry," you know, it would have been harder for me to make it. So I had to keep the reputation up. So I paid them off. I paid them like mid what we expected it to be. I remember it was like, you know, high of this and low of this. And I gave them what my mid estimation was. So then I was approached by a company called TriSynergy. And they said, hey, have you ever thought about doing your Warbirds for Microsoft Flight Simulator? And I said, Microsoft Flight Simulator? Like, I'm thinking, who wants to fly a Warbird that you're not going to be able to use the guns and do you know, dogfighting? I was like,
and valid they said, question.
Well, you know, they said, look, you're going to sell 2 to 3 times more copies. The odd, I was like, really? People are going to buy P-51s and P-40s and fly them just to fly them? And I should have known this because I'm a pilot, right? It just didn't occur to me. Because, of course, these are awesome airplanes. A P-51 is an incredible airplane in its own right. And then I thought to myself, oh, that's right. You know, if I go to an air museum, we just love looking at these planes. God, if they open the cockpit, it's a thrill. You get adrenaline just by sitting in the cockpit.
Yes. Yeah.
And if somebody said to me, hey, do you want to pull the plane out back and start it up? You'd be like a kid. Any kid who loves air would be like, oh, my God, they'd never forget that engine rumbling and shaking. And then if that person said, hey, you know what? You want to go flying? You'd be like, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. And I suddenly realized that, yes, this is extraordinarily exciting to fly these warbirds. You don't need to fire guns. You don't need to drop bombs. I'm not, you know, not a violence thing with me. I think it's just like playing war games. You know, I don't think of it as, I think it's an American thing. Okay. Americans can separate this from war, whereas Germans have a much harder time because a good friend of mine said, you know, you got to understand Scott, and he's German. He goes, as Germans, he goes, we remember war as being bombs falling down in our homes. He goes, Americans think of war as, you know, some troops overseas fighting. It's very different for Germans. Yes, so Americans you know, they can really, they don't really have the taste of what it's really about. So I think it makes, you know, probably big on war games for that reason. And it's a very strategic thing, and it's a game. Like I said, a game of technically chess is a war game. I guess you can look at it like that. You've got all different pieces. But so I went along with that, and then, you know, I was hit again. We had great success. I made heavy bombers and jets. with 7 add-ons to Microsoft Flight Simulator. Now, each of those, we had competition out there that were putting out these single aircraft, and they were terrible. I mean, they really were. I don't want to use certain derogatory word choices, but they were just horrible. They were junk. And I thought, oh, we are going to put 7 heavy bombers and jets in this pack, and we're going to sell it for the same price. And we're going to sell tons. But you know what happened? Nobody believed they were quality. Because when it came out in the store, they're like, oh, just another plane pack. And back then you had Abacus and another company that were making.
Oh, yes.
I remember on that.
They were making plane packs, and they were junk.
Yeah.
They were just, these guys were the cheapest junk dealers, you know, with airplanes. They ruined the genre back.
Yes.
Here I come out and I put this amazing product that every one of those airplanes exceeded any of the airplanes that were released. But what happened is it ended up getting in the bargain bin, and then we selling tons of them through the bargain bin. And the most common response was, hey, I finally picked up heavy bombers and jets for like $3 in the bargain bin, which, of course, we don't get anything with that. When they bargain bin it, the developer doesn't see anything. He said, I didn't buy it when it came out because I couldn't believe that it was going to be this good. I learned another lesson. Be careful when you over-deliver. You can over-deliver and hurt yourself. I mean, this prestige pricing and all that stuff in business. So another lesson learned. But it wasn't terrible because it really perpetuated our reputation. Our customers didn't know that we were broke. They just knew that we put out great products. So then what happened, unfortunately, a brick-and-mortar software store started to go south and the online downloadable content was taking over. That was fortunately for us because what was happening, because brick-and-mortar were drying up and going out of business, of course, all the product that we printed, you got to print like 10, 20,000 CDs, those would just go by the wayside, and the publisher has to recoup all of their expenses first. Another thing, I would have never signed that contract as a developer. Again, live and learn. You know, they get all their expenses paid off. So I worked for a year on a product with no money. Then I got to wait 6 months for the publisher to get all their publishers back, and then we get ours. So, but we did get money from that. It wasn't horrible. But then we decided, okay, we're breaking these guys out and we're selling them individually for a less price. And that immediately, it was so awesome to go from taking all this publishing, developing time, putting a product out, waiting for it to be printed, hit the stores, money to be transferred, everyone gets their cut, and then whatever crumbs are left, we get it. Now we go straight to the customer. That was just awesome for developers. Best thing. Yeah. So it was the turning point for A2A, then Shockwave, was the Stratocruiser. That was the turning point. We were supposed to release that Stratocruiser in December. I remember trying to get it out before Christmas. I was flat broke. I didn't know where my next paycheck. I had a 2-year-old kid, 4-year-old kid. It was no fun. And we started doing the cockpit of the Stratocruiser. So, for example, as a pilot, I'm looking, okay, the oil pressure, this isn't right. So, bang, can we fix that? Yeah, we can fix it. Great, awesome, we fixed that. So then it's like, oh, manifold pressure, this isn't how the way manifold pressure works. So we fix the manifold pressure. And then we find out, wait a minute, that, you know, the cylinder head temperature, that's not how cylinder head temperature reacts. You open the cowl flaps, things that don't take that long to change. We literally went through the entire cockpit. We should have started out with a Piper Cub. Had I realized I would have started out with a Piper Cub, but we started out with the most complicated airplane probably ever made, the Boeing 777.
It's true.
Yeah. 6 months later, and cash-strapped like you cannot imagine, everything. You're like at Vegas, and everything's on this one number. I'm like, this is it. And I told my guys, remember, we're going to split this into two. We're going to sell the airplane because a lot of people aren't going to want this realism, this massive realism. It's going to be too realistic. It's too hard. I can't start the airplane, all that stuff. And we're going to give you an Acusim add-on pack. So it's like $25 for the airplanes, $25 or $29 for the airplane, $25 for the pack, whatever we did. And my estimation, based on nothing except just a feeling, was we would sell 1 in 5 add-on packs. 1 in 5 people buy the add-on packs. I said, my plan is 1 in 5. And these people are going to be the real pilots and the real guys out there, the Andy Mahoods of PC Gamer. And they're all going to be, they're going to sell it for us to the masses. That was what I thought was going to happen. But when that airplane came out for the first time, and we had the airplane for 20 or 30 bucks, which was sort of standard cost, and then this Acusim pack, plug it in. We literally had a switch you could turn it on. I did that intentionally. I wanted you to be able to turn it on and turn it off, because then you would see, oh, I love Acusim. You turn that switch on, and everything starts shaking, and I hear everything better, and everything's real. So instead, it was the opposite. 80% reached for the Acusim pack. I was just busting. So
okay.
First day comes out. It was awesome to see money coming into the bank literally on that day. It was like I had never seen anything like that before. Money coming in. I saw the numbers coming in. And you know, it was a dent in my debt at the time, but I realized then, I saw those numbers coming in, and I said to my group, I said, guys, this is it. We now have our path. We are not moving from this path. We're not making an air combat game and getting strung out again. We are staying the course, and we're making add-ons for Microsoft Flight Simulator, because this is going to be our way out. And that's how it changed. That, and I saw people online, like they would take off and the engines would be overheating and they'd end up crashing. And I thought prior to that, that people would be like, oh, this game sucks. I hate this airplane. The engines are burning up. The opposite happened. Oh, this is so cool. I can't believe it. The engine. And they tried again. And then a couple days later, the same person who was crashing and burning the engines would be like, he'd be like, oh, I'm climbing right now. I'm passing 5,000 feet. Oh, my engine temps are right perfect right now. And they were so happy.
Yeah, perfect landing curve.
Of achievement. I realized at that point we had something, and it was brand spanking new. Nobody had ever seen anything like this level of realism in a cockpit, that the way the gauges were working. Nobody thought about engines overheating. It just didn't occur to them. And of course, as a pilot, it's huge. Engine temperatures are like everything, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really kind of easy for us in a way. I mean, it's not easy. It's extremely hard to do what we do, extraordinarily hard, especially with what we had to do with the Comanche. But it's easy in the sense that we to know what we want to do. We have no issue knowing what we want to do. The only question is, can we? So it's extraordinarily hard to fulfill it. But I also thought then, I said, oh God, I said, guys, we got a problem now, because now people are just, they want more. They just want more, and we can only put out like 2 planes a year. I said, guys, it's just going to be a mat. In no time, we're going to have people doing the same thing, and we're going to kind of miss the boat. We got to ramp up production. We got to get airplanes out. And to my surprise, and I don't want this to sound arrogant, but I was expecting some stiff competition in maybe 1 or 2 or 3 years. Just wasn't happening. From my point of view, from what I was seeing coming out, just wasn't happening. And I thought, geez, you know, I don't know what it is. You know, our customers love our airplanes. They love the realism. Why aren't other people doing this? I still don't exactly know the answer to that. I mean, it's certainly gotten better. The competition is, and I'm glad, I'm happy to have competition. I think it's wonderful to have competition, and it's certainly getting better, but it's taken a really long time. From my point of view, we're going back, I mean, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I was flying my Cherokee, I knew when I started that Cherokee how long it took that oil to warm up. Okay, there was nothing about technology or CPU horsepower preventing a programmer for making that oil instead of just going blip in 2 seconds right up to operating temperature, because that's what it used to do in my in the simulators. It's a blip, it just went right up and stopped. It's mechanical. I think it was because we didn't have pilots back in those days. We had I'm a computer geek, okay? I'm a nerd, okay? I'm proud to be. I love Star Trek. I get excited about things like the look. I got my communicator and phaser over there in the desk. I pick them up and use them every once in a while. But back then in the 1990s, the heyday, flight simulators were the AAA number one genre. That was the money, was in flight simulators. And in those days, developers were computer geeks. We were all computer geeks. You know, we all had. Yeah. So I think that's probably what happened, is they just didn't know what it was like. And then I'm a pilot. I go out there and I'm also a developer. So maybe historically, I think I might have just been one of the first pilot developers, maybe. That might have been it. So maybe that's why people weren't following, because unless you – and also aircraft owner. That's very important, because a lot of pilots that are not aircraft owners, they just don't care about these things. And it's natural. It's like you go to a hotel. You'll take a long hot shower. You don't care about it because it sounds awful because you're not paying the bill. You shower in your own bathroom. You know the oil bill that you're going to get paid. And yeah, I turn the water down. I'm a cheapskate like that. But I think that's probably what happened with the pilots. Because when you're not an owner, well, so what if I just take off without warming up the engine? What do I care? You know, I wouldn't have, personally, I'd never do that, but it's human nature, because we are survivalists. We survive by human nature. So we naturally, things that matter most to us, that affect our personal survival. So in that case, my survival is, oh my God, I do not want to lose this engine because it's a no-go. The engine is safe. $35,000, I don't have $35,000. If I lose the engine, I'm not flying. So it matters a tremendous amount to me. I'm going to research it. I'm going to find out everything about that engine, because I want that engine to last as long as it possibly can last, because it's so ridiculously expensive to maintain an airplane. So anyway.
This is really, really interesting, because you actually treat your products actually like a pilot who is just taking his aircraft into the simulator, but who wants to treat it in the simulator just like the real world. Because you could say, hey, now I'm in your simulator, now I'm happy, now I don't have to take care about all this stuff, you know, which can actually influence my flight, where I don't know, lose my engine. But I think with this with this attitude, you completely hit a lot of, or you fulfill what we hardcore nerd flight simulator guys want to have, you know, because we want to have that real experience, which is expensive, which where you have a lot of responsibilities in the real world. We want to have this in our computer. And I think this is why your products are standing out so much from the others which we have out there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. I love flight simulators so much that I know if something happened to me physically or I couldn't fly, I'd be fine. You know, flying is stressful. Owning and operating an airplane is stressful. It's just, when is something going to go wrong? You know, and I don't think I would own one if it wasn't my business to own one. If I owned one as just a hobby, it'd be a very modest airplane. I just wouldn't do that. And I can understand that. So I'm kind of lucky that it's a legitimate business. For me, it's a business expense, which makes it a lot more affordable to own an airplane, because if it's I use it for, I actually only use it for flight simulation. So for the most part, because for business, I should say. So the Comanche is transportation for me, and it's a flight test platform. You think I'd go flying for pleasure and stuff, but I don't. I don't really fly that Comanche just for pleasure. I guess maybe because I've flown it so much. I fly it when I need to fly it, and I enjoy flying it when I'm flying it. So I guess it's, but it's always a business need that calls me to the airport. And most of the vast majority is just testing. I can do things in that airplane that I just wouldn't want to ask somebody. Like I like put like weight on the tail. I want to see how many pounds it takes for the tail to come down and touch the ground in the back. And so, oh my God, my tail's on the ground. You know, people be like that. The airplanes. I don't have to worry about that with my airplane because I know it's, you know, I would never abuse it. But I can do things like that. Like I was the other day, I was popping wheelies because I wanted to know. At what point will the nose come off the ground if I go full power and full yoke back? Nobody really knows that answer because nobody does that.
Yeah, and it's not even in the books, is it?
No, because you would be on a short field takeoff or a soft field takeoff specifically. Mm-hmm. You'd be wanting to take just the weight off the nose wheel. So you're not going to want to be popping a wheelie. That's like irresponsible. But I need to know when that aircraft would completely pop a wheelie. A Cub is a perfect example. Somebody said to me, Cub owner said, yeah, you can balance the Cub on the mains. You can apply full power and just use your elevator and lift the tail up and just leave it there. They said it's fun, right? Well, I'm not going to do that with somebody else's Cub. And plus, I don't want to make a mistake. I'm not going to have a prop strike. So I don't know. I really know. I owned a Cub for about 6 months, not too long ago. I flied the heck out of it, and it was actually a great experience. And I did that test. I roped up the tail so the tail could go up just to the point where the prop wouldn't hit. I chocked the tires. So the tires are set, and I had the tail go up so the tail could go quite a bit high, but I knew it would not hit no matter how bad I did it. And I did that. Turned out it was really easy, right? But I want to know, well, can I go full stick forward? And at what speed does it, you know, happen? So I captured all the physics. But those are the kind of things, you, as an aircraft owner, it's your responsibility. It's your machine. If you break it, you break it. It's yours. And so it is very important to have done that Comanche on the Comanche because we owned it. So it was the only choice as far as I was concerned. I was not going to be renting a 172 from a flight school and start doing all that stuff with somebody else's airplane. I wouldn't want, frankly, would not want someone like me to doing that with their airplane, because why? What's in it for me? Yeah. You know, just fly.
Yeah, but I mean, in the past, you had other aircrafts than the Comanche, because the Comanche was the last one actually in a row of one. There was the 172. There were all the Warbirds. There was the which one was
182.
Yeah, but this Comanche,
and the Texan.
This Comanche. Yeah, went to a whole different level. Go on. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, I just wanted to come to one thing which is so special comparing to other add-ons, and that is the one that's, I would call it, the mystery of AccuSim, which is running in the background, which is obviously the core of your aircraft add-ons. I mean, you took your time now. You took about 2 years to develop it and to bring it to the new platform. How can you describe this platform? Is it is AccuSim something which you can plug to another aircraft where you can say, okay, I have this kind of computing mechanism where I can actually adapt it to another airplane? Or do we have an AccuSim for the Comanche? Will we have an AccuSim for another aircraft? How, maybe you can unlift a little bit the mystery of AccuSim there.
You know, Julius, that's a great question. And it's a question that a lot of people have guessed wrong when you put out the Comanche. Said, oh, A2A spent 3 years making this Comanche. So we didn't spend 3 years making this Comanche. We spent probably 2 years making the new, brand new engine. Okay. We actually used the Spitfire to make the engine. And then we moved it to the Comanche. And work really commenced on the Comanche specific in November last year. So it really took us about 8 months to make the Comanche. Now, this is 8 months to make an airplane with a brand new spanking engine. There's a lot of stuff to work out. As far as moving forward, it's not going to be the same type of work that we've been doing for the past 2.5 years. I never wanted to do the work that we've been doing for the past 2.5 years. It was very risky, mm-hmm. no guarantees, heavy investment in time and money. It's very difficult on the team to not have products out there. Very difficult on our customer base. They were atrophying before the Comanche came out. We had some diehards still hanging around, but the majority were like, where's A2A? And now that we put this out, it's so cool because all these people that from flying Microsoft Flight Simulator, they're like, oh, I've heard about A2A, but I've never flown an A2A product. Now I get what all the buzz was about. And it's so cool to hear that people, and I realized that we had to deliver something tremendous. It just, we could have put something out right away. Absolutely. We could have been the first one out of the gates if we wanted to. But And it was tough. Like, it's very tough on the team. Difficult. There was starting to have some second guessing because the technology, can we do this? Oh my God, this isn't going to work. Oh my God, they're right. I shouldn't have spent the last year going down this path. But I'm just so happy that it worked out. And we have it. So now that we have this technology, which we call AccuSim, I'll never have to make a Piper Comanche physics again. Because, you know, another thing people have to understand, physics don't change. These physics will be the same physics in 100 years. They will still work. They're getting the same real inputs, the same real outputs. It's physics. Some things of how it's delivered might change, whether it's, you know, certain frames per second or how it's going to be calculated. But the basic physics themselves don't change. And so the Comanche's in the bag. It's done. I'll never have to do another Piper Comanche ever again. So right now with Microsoft Flight Simulator, as far as we're concerned, we have no interest of working in another platform. What I mean?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I mean, Microsoft Flight Simulator is just so awesome.
And yeah, definitely.
I'll say it's run by an incredible guy. It's just run by a guy that right away when I met him, Jörg, he understands. Microsoft's very lucky to have that guy at the helm.
Yes.
Yeah. He's kind of an unsung hero. I don't think the people realize just how bold that guy has been. And how he has understood the community. And that's really, he is a big reason why we ended up making this enormous investment in the platform.
Yeah. I mean, this is what other developers keep telling us too, you know, that Jörg and especially the guys at Asobo are always very supportive and react to questions and stuff like this. Yes.
I have tremendous respect for what Asobo has done, what they've accomplished. The task that they have, it's almost like a thankless task because people are so quick to criticize. We've always elevated Microsoft way back in the FSX days. They lay the platform out. They changed everything. With their bold approach to the terrain, they didn't have to go that far, and they're continuously pushing it. And the weather systems as a pilot, it's fantastic. You've got those little showers that come down. It's exactly what it looks like from the air. And the clouds that are being created based on the atmosphere and moisture content. These aren't just like these little graphics. These clouds actually form into cumulus clouds. And then to make it seamless, real-time weather, I mean, I have no interest in doing that. I mean, come on. It's like, first of all, we couldn't. Right? Even if we could, I want to concentrate on the airplanes. Airplanes are all I want to do. Let me do the airplane and Microsoft does the rest. So we're in a really, really great time for flight simulation now.
That's right. Yeah. So you have now the, let's say, AccuSim
and base engine where the Comanche is in already, yeah, and then you can connect it.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the flight simulator or...
So we're going to be in that Microsoft store very soon.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Ah, that's great.
Okay.
Yeah. So the question Julius already asked, but maybe I will do it more precise, is if you now want to develop some different aircraft, let's say Cessna 172, for example, yeah? So you need to program it or develop it only for the, let's say, AccuSim engine, yeah? And then you can connect it as well to the flight simulator, let's say, like an easy thing?
It's going to be a whole different type of workflow. Now,
okay.
Because we're no longer working on the engine. Okay, we're just making airplanes.
Specific parts.
I think of it as production. We made the factory. Spent a year and a half, almost 2 years making the factory. I do not want to make another factory. I have no interest in making another factory. I love this factory. It's I'll tell you something. Health-wise, starting in November, I was working, and this is literally every single day, 7 days a week until release. Until about 1 month after release. But there wasn't a single day off. And you think, how do you do that? You must be going crazy. Your health must be. But I've been very healthy working on that because of the development environment. And I got my team to thank for that. I didn't create the development environment. Mia Krofcha created the base. He creates the nuts. He creates the machine. And we work together. And then I create the physics and sound. So I make all the systems and he makes all the avionics. Fantastic radios. And then we have an artist that's just dedicated to the artwork, Miel Puto. And then Rob was just dedicated to that tablet. Rob is a brilliant artist. He now wants to become a full-time programmer. So he's a great programmer. And he's the one who's that tablet.
That's great.
And then we had that walk around, that was another thing. That walk around had us in a dizzy for 6 months. How are we going to do this?
Yeah. I think, what the surprising thing for me about the Comanche was we all knew AccuSim. We knew what we got with the walk around, et cetera, with the pictures, in P3D and FSX. We knew what AccuSim is. So we actually all just expected to have the thing we had in FSX P3 ported over to the new platform.
We tried
that. You kind of remodeled it and invented a new step, or you went to the new step, and that was the surprising thing, that it even became better than it already was. It was pretty damn good, but now it's beyond that. So that was really impressive when you released the add-on, I have to say. That was really nice, yeah.
Yeah, so we're very happy with it. We're very happy with the response. So we like I said, the factory is gonna just pump. We're hoping to be, putting out airplanes at a faster rate at this level than we've done in the past. I don't think that's necessarily gonna be the case. I think we might be back to a 2-airplane per year thing. There's a level of quality we just got to hit. But we want to hit it as fast as possible because I don't want to just put 2 planes out a year. I'd like to put 3 planes. If we could do 3 planes a year, I don't see that pot.
Let's do it.
We are ready for it. Come on.
Yeah.
But coming to that, to the planes you are about to want to put out. There's one in the Scott Gentile hangar which I'm really curious about, and I think Barry Seal made it, or Tom Cruise made it famous in the movie Barry Seal.
Oh yeah.
And you had a belly landing with it. Of course, I'm talking about the Aerostar. I think 2 years ago or 3 years ago you announced this aircraft officially for P3D, then said you will move on to MSFS. How is the aircraft doing?
Well, we did not want to start with the twin. We wanted to start with a working owned airplane, which was the Comanche. So now we have the Aerostar exists. So we are working on the Aerostar at the moment. We're not sure if it's going to be the next airplane or not, but we certainly, I fortunately took a lot of videos of my Aerostar, did a lot of Acusim testing. I was doing all those stalls and stuff. I know the airplane extremely well. It's an awesome airplane. I mean, oh God, the Aerostar just, it's just, they call it, it's been called the Death Star because it's killed a lot of pilots. But let me tell you something. It's anybody who says the Aerostar is inherently a dangerous plane just does not know what they're talking about. It's a dove. It handles like a dove. In fact, it handles more gracefully than a Cessna 172. So that'll put things into perspective. A Cessna 172 has a worse stall characteristic than an Aerostar. Okay.
Okay.
So I don't see Cessna 172s being called the Aerostar. It's just, there's just two elements to what makes it dangerous. It's fast, right? So you got to think a little quicker. Some people aren't used to that. You'd be surprised how quickly you acclimate to that. You'd be really surprised. The first time you fly this really fast, you're like, oh my God, it's so fast. But then all of a sudden, within like three or four times landing, it just starts feeling normal and everything else seems really slow. That's really what happens. And the faster the airplane, the smaller the wing, the easier it is to land. You pull the throttle back, it drops like a rock. Add the throttle, it doesn't. You just put it right in the numbers every time. I don't even think I've ever had a bad landing in the Aerostar. I have bad landings in the Comanche all the time. I don't, not in the Aerostar. Aerostar is so easy, puts it down. You can put it down in the smallest airports. Taking it off is a different story. Yeah, you can get off the ground. But what makes an Aerostar dangerous is, one, it's fast. And there are a lot of pilots out there that should have no business flying a fast airplane, okay? But it's a twin. I'll tell you something. Flying with two engines is, you know, when you go to an insurance company, you look for insurance, you think, oh, I got two engines. My insurance rate should come down, right? No, they go up. They double. The insurance companies know, okay? Flying two engines, it's simply more dangerous than flying single. If you are flying two engines out of only airports that you are flying 737s out of, then it's a safer airplane. The moment that twin engine is going into a small airport, it becomes insanely more dangerous than a single.
Okay, why?
Just think about it. Just think of the way the mind works. I fortunately had a lot of little aircraft failures in my life, including in the Aerostar. Mm-hmm. And I've had an opportunity to review them. Like if you have an engine quit on you or something in an airplane, which I've had happen, you get home and you think, how did I do? Now I'm going to review exactly every decision I made and when. What I discovered and learned about the human mind when it comes to being a pilot is when something happens, it takes your brain seconds to process, just accept that the engine's quit. Now, let's say it's 3 seconds. Now you know the engine has quit after 3 seconds. Now you have to figure out what the hell to do. Are you gonna pull out your checklist? You might. But if you're like at 10,000 feet and the engine quits, yeah, you might actually pitch. You might pitch down for a proper, you know, glide. And you might pull the checklist out and take your time and do it. There's nothing wrong with that. But a lot of times you're not going to be in that position. You might be at 1,500 feet. The engine quits. You don't have time to pull the checklist out. You go, oh, whoa, gas? What's going on here? You put the fuel pump on. You're just thinking it has to be either ignition or gas. It could technically be air. Technically, your air cleaner could be clogged, but that's not going to happen. You could have just a carburetor failure. You could have a unlikely to be distributor based because you have a fully redundant magneto system. So typically, it's going to be based on either combustion, major failure. Like I suppose you could break a crankshaft. That would certainly do it. You could have some sort of, you know, major failure. Most likely it's going to be fuel related. But anyway, you're going to process this stuff and it's going to take you 3 seconds to figure out the engine's quit. It's now going to take you time to figure out what to do. okay, let's say it's 20 seconds before you've done the right thing. And that's actually pretty quick. But that's going to seem like a lifetime in that situation, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure, yeah.
In a single engine airplane, you're only concerned about one engine. And when that engine quits, there is no adverse reaction to the airplane. All that's happening is that as the nose comes down, you're all chilled out, you're flying. Nose is down, no big deal. Pitch. Twin engine, 3 seconds to figure out an engine is even quit. Now you have to figure out what engine is quit. I tell you, it takes you a couple seconds to figure that out. You got to figure out, is it my right engine or is it my left engine? And you have this little process you go on as a twin engine pilot. You do certain things to determine whether it's in it. For me, I would just see the nose is pointing right, so I now know that my right engine is creating it's drag, left engine is still creating thrust, but still takes 2 seconds. So now you have 5 seconds. During that time in a twin, you have one engine that is producing power and another engine that is now a brake. So during that whole time, now you're kind of going sideways and you're slowing down really rapidly because you're going sideways.
Yes, yeah.
So you're taking off in an airplane. You're just getting off the ground. You're taking off. You're just tucking up your landing gear. You're not too high above stall speed and you lose an engine in a single. The only thing your mind is going to be doing, I lost my engine. You're pitching the nose down and you're putting the airplane down. I got that field. Boom. I'm on the field. Boom. Twin engine, forget it. A twin engine, an engine quits. It's going to deaccelerate really fast. And now you're going to be going sideways. So now you're going to be looking at a spin. We've seen countless videos of people spinning twin engines in. It's that poor pilot is just trying to process what's going on. Takeoff is absolutely the most dangerous time in a twin. In the Aerostar, once you lift off, because it has those small wings, Aerostar wants to go fast. You're tucking up the gear. It's probably about a minute before that airplane is able to sustain itself on one engine because the gear is incredibly draggy. It takes like 9 or 10 seconds to come up. The flaps are kind of down. So, and the plane feels like it takes forever to reach that 140 knot speed. Mm-hmm. Once it hits 140, it's like you blink and you're doing 180. Because once it hits 140, the plane sits up and it starts flying proper. 140 knots indicated is a mush speed for an Aerostar. So I find that to be really fascinating from a simulator point of view because, once this airplane, comes out, assuming that we get it out, it's going to be amazing to just take off that airplane and experience how scary it is to lose an engine before you reach 140 knots. Yeah. It's a long time. Comanche, I'm taking off of a small airport. You can take a very steep climb out. So you can drop flaps, full power. You can do like a soft field, a VX climb out where you climb in a maximum angle. You can just, and if you lose the engine at any time, guess what? I shouldn't say any time. No, there's a very short window. When you're taking off, but you're going to get to that I can turn around point pretty quickly in the Comanche, maybe like 800 feet above the ground. That's why twins are so much more dangerous, and also landing as well. It's very difficult to land an airplane in the pattern and to know that you can make the airport if you lose an engine. Most pilots, if you watch them in the pattern, if they lose the engine when they're beyond their downwind leg, will not make the airport if they lose their engine. And it's pretty scary because the airport I'm out of has a big like a cliff at the edge of the airport. That would be death. You go right into the cliff. It would be a very blunt impact. You go out to, I don't know what it's like in Germany, but in the United States, the tremendous areas in the mid sections and the western sections of the United States, the whole entire state is an airport. There's, literally, the whole state. That's where you want to fly an Aerostar. if you're going to be flying.
Okay. It's safe.
You land anywhere. You just put it down on a road or you put it down in a field. It's a beautiful thing. Where I'm here now, it's not too bad. You've got a lot of fields. I would say where I live in New England. You at 1,000 feet AGL, you could pull my engine at any time and I'll have a field that I can put it down or a road. But that's not the case with if you're going to land into an airport in the city. I always find that to be pretty scary, single engine flying into over a city. You lose the engine. That is not a place. You don't want to go down the city street. You know, that's not going to be good. So, I've done a lot of thinking about that. And my plan is for the Aerostar to really, hopefully, get twin engine pilots a little more, I would say, aware and scared. And I think actually the Comanche has done that. I love these engine out videos because people are flying along. You can put the Comanche on 1,000x accelerated failure rate, which tells you it's going to fail and you're going to be going down in like an hour. So if you put it on 1,000x and take off, try to make an hour's flight, like pick an airport. I can try to make it there or try to make it across a mountain range or something like that at a certain altitude. The Comanche has taught people dead stick landings. You see that happening all the time, these content creators. And it's so awesome seeing the engine go out and the amount of fun that they have. And what I love is their reaction is when the engine goes out, you see his face. You're like, what's going on? What's that sound? and you're watching. You are literally watching in action. And I've got a bunch of those videos that I've marked and put in the forums. They're so entertaining to watch. And you can see the adrenaline goes up. The guy's like, oh, my God, what's going on? And, of course, I'm looking at it, and I usually can tell what's going on. It's like, oh, come on. You know, you can't you see you've lost lost a bunch of cylinders there, and the cylinders keep failing. It keeps getting worse and worse. Like he thinks he can make it to that field, and then something else fails. So it's a lot of fun. I think Two Tone Murphy wants to do a multiplayer flight where they get a bunch of guys flying at 1,000x, all fly together, and see if they can make
a cool idea. Yeah,
and make a flight because it'll be, oh my God, we lost Pete. Pete, there's a field over there. Make the field.
Yeah, great idea.
We'll reach the target. Yeah. Okay.
Listening to you is for me like I don't know. I can't explain it. It's really interesting to hear you and listening to you. All the details. You are right. You are a nerd. That's proved. that's right. Yeah. And it's good that you are a nerd. Where does it come from? Is there any reason why you are so much into it in all the details and details and details and details? Where does it come from?
My older brother's the same way. He was just really driven to, he was really into sound, and it's just so funny. We used to way back in the day with phonographs, we were looking for the ultimate tape cassette player that was perfect sound, and he used to come over with his friend. They'd put the tape in, they'd play the record, have the tape record the record, and then they play it back at exactly the same speed. You turn around blindfolded and they switch an A, B and see if you could tell the difference. What was the recording? What was the tape? And the goal was to find that tape deck that that produced the sound perfectly. So I think it's just in our blood, just curiosity. It was just so. I remember him coming home one day. I was like 14 years old or 13. He was like 17. He came home with this gigantic tape deck. It was like the size of a big mixing desk. It was this huge. I finally got it. We got the perfect sound. Turned out it was just, it was worse than his other deck. And he kind of learned then, you know. He learned. It turned out that he had this one Iowa deck that was the deck. It was a perfect deck. It was like a 2550, if I remember, AD 2550. Fantastic deck. But anyway, yeah, it's just you can be that way about guitars, right? Guitar, I don't know if you guys are musicians. Guitars are incredible.
I play guitar. Yeah. I'm a huge guitar nerd, yeah.
Well, yeah, I got guitars all over here. So that's the well, when it would show the video when we're done here, I'll give you a little tour here of all my guitars I have in here. They're just beautiful, beautiful instruments, and there's a meticulousness. I want them all to be just. I want them in tune, so when I pick up the guitar, it's just I can just play it, and I want the neck just right. You know, as a guitarist, you don't want problems with the guitar. Some acoustic guitars, you got to deal with collapsing frames and stuff, some vintage guitars. So you got to do some little different things to maintain them, but I think it's the same thing with the Comanche. We all love Han Solo in Star Wars. Come on, that was a dream. I think we all dreamed about being him. And I think that's kind of the way I feel in the Comanche. It's a cockpit. It's a...
Yes.
It's
a... yeah, it's... I think the great thing is that it's alive, you know? I think when I start up the Comanche in the simulator, the great thing is every flight is different from the one before, you know? The engine kind of has its own life. It's not like with other add-ons, all the cold and darks are all the same. No, every cold and dark... is a different from the one which happened before. And this is kind of, this is interesting. I have to tell you a little story. When you released the...
I have to stop you. I'm pretty shocked about that your every cold and dark is different yours, Julius, because most of the time you are crashing airplanes.
That's
so
not
you
true.
Showed load the default one always. So I'm okay, but anyways, continue.
Yeah, he always has to say that in every podcast. Yeah. He has to start the rumor that I'm crashing airplanes, but in reality, it's the other way around, you know?
No, it's not.
But I wanted to just come back to a story where I was taking out the Constellation across the North Atlantic back in, I think it was 10 years ago, 5 years ago. I don't remember, in P3D, and I loved flying this airplane, you know, with the superchargers and operating everything. So can I ask you, will we ever see this one in Microsoft Flight Simulator?
I would very much like to, because the captain of the ship, like AccuSim, is its own system.
Ah, okay.
Heidi is very specific how she operates, what she does. The crew is specific to what they do. The system dynamically can tell when you're in a cruise, when you're in a climb. You don't have to tell it you're in it. It knows whether you're in final. It determines that through an AI routine. And the passengers also have a lot of things that they're looking for. They're very, very, look, when I'm flying it, they're very concerned about their meals. You know, you got to time things out. You know, if you're going to stretch somebody out, you're not going to feed them. Or you're feeding them, you got to cut them short. They do not like that, you know. And so I thought that was really interesting. I hate it when I go flying in the airlines and you get like the bag of peanuts or something like that. It's like, I mean, it depends. If it's a short flight, then fine. But if it's kind of a long flight, you kind of expect to have something, you know, to help you pass the time. But I love the captain of the ship, but it's different to the Comanche. So if we did captain of the ship, we would absolutely use the AccuSim engine as it is. I could see it conceivable to doing a captain of the ship, but I don't know. I'm thinking about this. I don't know. We'd have to.
Okay, so there are no plans at the moment to do that.
We're not doing it right now. But yeah, I look at the bucket theory. I try to tell people you can only put so much in a bucket, and a bucket is the product. So if I'm going to do captain of the ship, am I able to do everything the Comanche is plus captain of the ship? Probably not. I might not have a walk around, for example. I might let the walk around go. If I did captain the ship, I'd certainly want the maintenance hangar. And I would actually like to get Heidi in the aircraft somewhere. Mm-hmm. She also is a personality that was developed. And she reacts to very specific things. She's pretty damn smart. Pretty damn smart the way she reacts. And I thought it'd be really cool to have a passenger with you. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's great.
Just interesting. Yeah. You know, nice little, she makes these little comments and just believable.
Yeah. And I that made her scream one time, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that comes from my experience that it's very difficult to predict how somebody's going to behave. Some people you think that might be scared of airplanes, it's like a roller coaster to them. They love it. Some people that you think might be great are petrified. It's a very weird thing. One question I've learned to ask is, do you like roller coasters? Typically, if somebody really loves roller coasters, they'll be okay. If somebody's like iffy about roller coasters, you know you got somebody. And some people, you don't realize until you get off the ground, they're freaking out. You realize, you look over there and you're like, oh my God, this person's about to have an anxiety attack. And you guys, oh no, everything's cool. Everything's cool. We're just going to fly straight and level. And they're just like trying to keep it together. And it's an awful feeling having somebody in the cockpit that's freaking out. It could be very dangerous as well to have somebody who's,
of course,
you know. So that's where Heidi came from, was that experience of of getting people from being petrified to being just, oh my God, they just want to do loops and all sorts of stuff all day long.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I didn't think about that now, about the captain shot off the ship experience, of course, was this other thing, you know, with the whole additional experience of having passengers and having a career mode, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Doing a good landing.
Yeah, making a good landing.
And the
yeah,
landing's people, huge. Yeah. Yes. It's not fair to a pilot, but they are judged by their landing. It could be the most perfect flight in the world. It makes a tough landing. And it could be a horrible flight, and then all of a sudden, a beautiful landing, it's going to help. So I did a lot of thought about that. I wanted it to be natural. I didn't want people to feel cheated either. So that's a very the captain of the ship is a well-tested system. It's like having a really good game that has been like a nice board game that has been tested and tested and balanced out. So I'd be more apt to just take the captain of the ship nuts and bolts and bring him in exactly as they are. I'd be very careful cracking that thing open and adding changes because you know, you could really ruin it and mess it up.
And coming back to your roots, I mean, you said also in the development of AccuSim version 2, you kind of were with a, what was it, the P-51, I guess, the Mustang, and then you switched to the Comanche. So what are the plans for the Warbirds? Because in the portfolio of A2A simulations, there have been or there are a lot of Warbirds. I mean,
we want to do a Warbird. That's a tailwheel aircraft. It's a whole different thing now. So we want to make sure that we got that just right. And it needs to be an airplane that I have full-on access to. Full-on.
Okay, yeah, of course, yeah.
So this is always a requirement for you to have an aircraft?
At this point, yes. It might not become one because the way I look at it is this engine, we can create, you know, we can create anything. We can create a rocket. We can create a gyrocopter. We can create a glider. We can create a 747. The engine, AccuSim, doesn't care. I could build a fictitious airplane in about, you know, 10 minutes with AccuSim, and it will fly. It'll fly. Theoretically, it should be able to create a 747 or a F-104 or a triplane or, like I said, a rocket. It should be able to create all that stuff to be pretty damn close to accurate. But I won't know that answer until I've done like 4, 5, or 6 airplanes. So if I'm doing a P-51 and I create the P-51 and then I fly it and it's like, damn, this thing flies just like the P-51. The roll rates, the climb, it's flying exactly like my flight test, then great. But then if I do that and it's like, well, this is a little faster or the roll rate's a little bit here or I've got a little bit more longitudinal stability or there's a little more of this, a little bit of that. Those differences, again, we don't put Band-Aids on them. We ask the question why. And I love asking those questions. And Emil Krofczyk and I will just, you know, have physics discussions and why is this, why is that? The great thing with AccuSim is it makes the airplane immediately fly really nicely. We bring it as far as we can with proper physics. And then if we get to 98%, then the last 2%, yeah, you scale that stuff in. One of the biggest parts of AccuSim was getting that natural turbulent response to the airplane. I think that's probably what people are reacting to the most when they fly it, and they go, "Oh my God, this thing flies so good." I think they're reacting to the way the airplane is responding to the air, because that's what it's mm-hmm. like when you're in an airplane, just getting bounced around, getting bumped.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting with the physics model you have there in AccuSim. I mean, theoretically speaking, could I bring you a, let's say I have a very great 3D model of a 737. Could I connect it to AccuSim?
Sure. Like I said, we can build anything. It's basically just an airframe, propulsion, propellers, and the weight and balance. That gets you to like 95% of where you want to be. The last 5%, you just have to accept. You don't know. Nobody knows. Even in the most complicated wind tunnel software that is used for designing airplanes today, the airplanes do not fly like the prototype. The engineers expect this, and they never get exactly what they're expecting. Yes. And they literally put everything in exact. And this is not real-time physics stuff. This is like the computer can sit there and tabulate all night long if it wants to tell you what it's going to be doing. And that's very impressive to look at some of these wind tunnel programs. I mean, the way the vortices spin off the wing, you're looking at, my God, that looks real. Mm. It's got to be real. Well, guess what? It's not real. It's real to what they understand to be real. We like to think that science just has all the answers, and they just don't. And it's very important that we know as scientists and engineers what we don't know. And I think what happens is there's a lot of arrogance in the scientific and engineering community that, oh, I know everything there is to know. Well, guess what? You don't. I don't even think they can tell you exactly how a Frisbee flies. I mean, it's just they don't. You take something so simple as a Frisbee. It's just so many things can happen when you toss that Frisbee through the air. I mean, it's going through fluid. I just waved my arms, right? I don't see it, but I just sent vortices all over the room. They probably go out 20 feet and probably hitting that mirror over there, you know. You know that when you have a beam of light coming into your office and if there's any dust and you suddenly say, oh my God, there, look at the dust in the room. You don't realize you're breathing this stuff in all the time. But
So that's maybe the reason why they put parachutes with them on the first flight, because they never know what to expect. And they can predict at least, let's say, 98%, but there's still 2% where you don't know what is going to be happening.
I think the key for us is I accept as a person, I have respect for Mother Nature and physics. And look, you know, we don't know everything. Certain things we know. Yeah. We know we can say certain things. We know that. You know, I don't want to get off on a crazy subject here, but they don't even know what gravity is. All they know is what gravity does. Nobody can explain to you why gravity exists. It's like, okay, we just accept it. So it's like we do a lot of that. We just see things. And actually, that's a lot how AccuSim physics was made, is just the same way that they make any kind of other physics equations. We basically just observe. Oh, this is happening. Oh, you know, the wheel hits the ground and oh, the tire is doing this. The tire has a certain amount of physics going on. That's actually an extremely complicated thing, just modeling a tire. It's physics as it meets the road.
Okay. I have one final question, if you let me.
Sure.
What about, have you ever thought of that you might cooperate with other add-on designers who say, hey, Is there a possibility that you say, okay, we have this technology, we will offer it to other add-on developers?
I have nothing against that, but I think the problem with that is you get into a support situation, right? And then do I want my name on someone else's product? Because that becomes a problem. Because if my name's in their product, now my name's on their product. And now it's like, what happens if they're not giving good customer service? We're huge on customer service. We got two dedicated guys that just comb the forums. And I do customer service as well. So, I just want to be very careful of that. We just want to make airplanes. If we can pay the bills and be doing what we're doing, and a lot of people think of business and expanding and expanding and go, let's grow, let's grow, let's grow. I'm actually at the point now, I've come to the point where I like A2A, the small size we are. We're a family. I don't think I have got a single person working for me that I haven't been working with for like 10 years. It's like everyone's working with the 10 to, we're a family. We're in there for the long haul. And what's important to me as a person is that I do right by the everybody who works for A2A, in that we're all happy doing what we want to do. That's really all that matters. I don't, and part of being happy obviously is making airplanes. Now, if we could hire more people and make twice the amount of airplanes, yeah, we'd like to do that, but that's a big step. I'm now hiring more people, and I don't have any, we have no drama in A2A. There's no, there's no bickering whatsoever. We're like a family. It gets around the dinner table. We are spirited, right? Lewis and I are spirited, opinionated and stuff. So you have the family kind of arguments, but it's all, we're just so tight. And so I realize we've got a very tight crew. I got a lot of young guys in the group too, and we're just happy doing what we're doing. So I've kind of accepted the fact that I don't want to expand. I just want to keep doing what we're doing for now. And our goal now is to put out airplanes for Microsoft Flight Simulator. And that's, I mean, we are a Microsoft Flight Simulator shop, is the way I look at it. And nothing against X-Plane, you know, nothing against them at all. I'm sure it's a great platform. And yes, it would be easier for us to bring AccuSim into X-Plane now than ever. But just think about it from our point of view. Do we want to spend time porting the same airplane into a different platform and then have to support that platform? Or would we rather take that time and make another airplane? See, from our point of view, we just want to keep making airplanes. And Microsoft has just delivered a great platform. You know, things can change, I suppose. Anything can change, but we're really happy with this relationship, and we see it going on and on and on for, you know,
for hopefully many more decades.
Yeah,
that we can all enjoy. Because at the end, I mean, we are the consumers. We can take the aircraft out virtually, and we've been enjoying that now for 20 years and now are able to do that in the Microsoft Flight Simulator, and that's simply amazing. So thank you for making that possible, and thank you to your entire team and whoever made it possible that we are where we are. And I cannot thank you enough for doing this with us, to actually share this stories. It's so interesting, the level of dedication you bring along. Because you just said this in your final, allow me that comment, but just in the final statement you now made, you could really see you're not running as a business which has to expand. You're running it out of pure dedication, because you just want to see, you want to see a good product. You still have this desire you had back 30 or 25 years back when you started making effects for the Combat Flight Simulator. And thank you for that. Thank you for that, because there are guys like you, and then there are other guys who are just try to expand, and then the quality is kind of going away. And Thomas, Rafi, any final words for Scott?
No, I'm totally impressed and can back what you have said. And Scott, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tommy.
One little thing, or one little question maybe. What would you like to have in future, let's say from the simulator side, or let's say the Microsoft Flight Simulator side? Yeah, is there kind of feature or kind of thing you need to have in future to say that would be a thing where you say, okay, that would make my products maybe a little bit more better, detailed, etc., etc.? Or are you happy like it is now?
I'm happy with them doing what they're doing and them following their passion. And we just continue to follow our passion with the airplanes, because they have, right now, it has a great interface, great world, great weather. Some people have mentioned some things about the air traffic control. I really don't use it that much.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah.
Air traffic control. No, what I've heard, it impresses me. I can tell they've done a lot of work on it. I just haven't really put it through its paces, but it does impress me. I, as a pilot, I'm impressed with what I hear. But like I said, I can't really speak to that. But no, I'm just thoroughly pleased with Jurg and what he is. He's quarterbacked everything. I'm just really really impressed with it.
So if the head of the A2A family is happy, we as a customer can be happy as well.
We all want the same thing. Yeah. We all want the same thing. You want the same thing I want. So,
yeah, definitely. So big thank you from my side also to you and your, let's say, family. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Okay, so I think we wrap it up here. Thank you very, very much for coming to us. It was great having you. And also thank you for all the listeners, international listeners out there. We are usually a German-speaking podcast, but from time to time we have international guests, and then you're very welcome to listen to our little podcast here. This was episode 75 of Die Simulanten, your cruise-level podcast for flight simulation. Scott, I wish you a very nice day. We will press the stop button now all together, and then you can show us your guitars.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, start the music, Raffi. Take care. My name is Julius. Have a great week. And yeah, we hear to our German listeners. Bis in zwei Wochen.
Thanks, Julius.
See you in 2 weeks. Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.